I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, alongside my co-host, Matt Miller.
Every business day, we bring you interviews from CEOs, market pros, and Bloomberg experts, along with essential market-moving news.
Find the Bloomberg Markets Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and at Bloomberg.com/podcast.
You know, we are on top of this crypto space here on this show, and it's becoming clearer and clearer that some regulation is coming to the world of crypto. Let's get some more color on that. Mary Beth Buchanan, President of the Americas and Global Chief Legal Officer at Merkle Science. Mary Beth, it just feels like the drumbeat is really beginning to pound here for regulation of what is a growing crypto market. Gary Gensler, a new head of the SEC, certainly making some comments there. How do you think this will kind of really evolve over time?
You know, I think there's been a lot of really great news in the cryptocurrency space in the last few weeks. And as crypto continues to grow and have mass adoption, not just in the U.S., but across the globe, regulators are taking a much closer look at it. And they're looking at many different aspects, from stablecoins to DeFi to new expected guidance coming out today from the FATF. It's an exciting time, but I agree with you that additional regulation will be coming.
So it's interesting to think about Gary Gensler regulating this space. Is Bitcoin a security?
No, I think that Gary Gensler is certainly in a great position to understand the cryptocurrency markets, as he's been teaching it at MIT. The SEC has been pretty clear that Bitcoin is not a security, and so I don't think that there's any danger that this is going to change in the near future.
So, Mary Beth, the U.S. Justice Department created a national cryptocurrency enforcement team. That sounds ominous. What is that?
Yeah, the cryptocurrency enforcement team that was announced in early October by the Deputy Attorney General is an effort by many different components of the Department of Justice to come together and to really attack one of the latest plagues in the crypto space, which is ransomware attacks. Ransomware attacks have gone up 151% in 2021 as compared to 2020, and so this task force is going to help root out those who would use cryptocurrency to try to attack and strangle businesses in the U.S. and throughout the globe.
What you've been involved in the digital space for quite a while now. What can be done? You know, whenever I see a ransomware attack, I always think that's silly because it's not an anonymous transaction. We know that it's going to wallets, we know which wallets it's trading in, but those wallets aren't attached to names, right? So what can be done?
In order to really attack the ransomware actors, we're going to need to see a lot of collaboration between cryptocurrency exchanges, blockchain analytics companies like Merkle Science, and the government. Recently, in late summer, the Justice Department called the industry together and shared with us some of the information that they've been learning with recent ransomware attacks, and we shared with the government some information that we've been learning. So I think that through this collaboration and information sharing, we're going to be able to stop these attackers before they can find additional victims.
So you know, Mary Beth, a lot of folks are saying that the crypto space really needs regulation, if for no other reason than for it to be validated and for its development and for more investment. How do you think this is going to play out? Is this something that our government currently has the capability to regulate? It just feels like so much is new about crypto and the knowledge level isn't anywhere where it needs to be.
I think most of the private sector crypto companies want regulation, but they want clear regulation, and they want to have a voice in creating it. Right now, we do have a patchwork of regulations in the United States. We have different agencies that are looking at different aspects of how cryptocurrency operates. There may be a few spaces where we're still seeing the absence of some regulation. And what we need to do, I think, is identify where there's a vacuum and create a reasonable set of rules that make sense to make sure that we're addressing all aspects of the crypto space.
I mean, what you do, or at least part of what you do, is you help financial companies, government entities, as you were saying, crypto companies, prevent attacks, prevent, you know, getting ripped off, basically. If I'm an investor, my main concern is, where do I hold this stuff? If I put $1 million or $2 million into crypto, I want somebody I can trust custodying that asset. Are we in a place where there is a safe and trustworthy place for me to put those assets?
There are a number of extremely well-respected custodians that are holding cryptocurrency today. And those custodians are regulated. They are utilizing the latest technology to monitor their transactions, to know who they're doing business with. And there are many options out there today, from the traditional crypto custodian and even to certain U.S. banks that are launching crypto custody services.
All right. Very cool to get some time with you, Mary Beth. I hope we can get you back, because it seems to me Merkle Science has a wealth of information that I think our clients would like to hear more about. Mary Beth Buchanan is president of the Americas and global chief legal officer for Merkle Science. Now let's bring in David Kudlow right now. He's the CEO and chief investment strategist at Mainstay Capital Management. They've got $3.8 billion in assets under management out of Michigan. David, always great to get you on the horn. Thanks so much for joining us. Let's talk about, it seems like there are so many headwinds. You've got the supply chain constraints. You've got a labor shortage. We have inflation that looks more than transitory, whatever that means. And now a budding energy crisis. Should I be worried as an equities investor?
Hey, good morning. Yeah, and I would add to that we have consumer sentiment is been falling, confidence in the economy has been falling. And, you know, if we look at the GDP numbers as forecasted by the Atlanta Fed, their GDP Now numbers, they've fallen over the past few months from close to 7% projection for third quarter GDP down to 0.5%, dangerously close to a quarter of contraction, although consensus estimates for GDP are quite a bit higher, around 3%, 3.5% for the third quarter. So, yeah, we have all these headwinds that are coming toward us. I think first and foremost is the probability, what most people think, that the Fed will start to taper before the end of the year, and that doesn't mean eliminating liquidity to providing, but start to taper and scale it back. And then they're talking about interest rates rising as soon as the middle of next year, which we don't think will happen. But, you know, with that, on the positive side is we have just stellar corporate earnings in this year. And as liquidity is taken out of the system and we come back to fundamentals, we look at fundamentals for the market, specifically price to earnings ratios. They're very, very good. They've actually come down through the year because earnings have been so good. We set a record in the first quarter, second best in the second, and we expect the third best quarter here in the third quarter. It's easy comparisons because of COVID, but it's also because corporations have just got good balance sheets and have done really good in this recovery from COVID and going forward. So on that side of the equation, the most important thing, because in the long term, that's what stocks should be priced on, is earnings. You know, we're just looking at incredible earnings and profit margins in 2021 and really going forward in the fourth quarter as well.
David, I look at WTI crude at north of $80 a barrel. Have I missed the energy trade?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I mean, it's our favorite sector for the second half of this year, are still our favorite sector coming into the fourth quarter. is energy. And, you know, we look around the world at what's going on. The OPEC hasn't helped out on the oil front. They've got another meeting next month. We'll see what happens. But it is, you know, a function of this recovery, this robust recovery we've had around the world from COVID, and as economies are expanding, they're demanding more energy. There's been significant, when we look at renewables, right? The emphasis has been on renewables, you know, for good reasons. You know, we all want renewable, sustainable energy. But right now in the U.S., that makes up about 12% of our energy supply. There's still about 80% that comes from fossil fuels. In China, that's even higher. So, you know, we have the natural gas issues in Europe and globally. We actually have coal-burning plants that are being fired back up or increasing production. We're expecting coal to be at the highest level of use in this country since 2014, and that's because of switches from LNG or natural gas to coal because of the short supplies. So I think the energy trade has further to go, and I think that it makes sense for investors to still continue to have exposure there.
What do you think about the rates moves that we've seen recently, David? That 2 years, regardless of region, were sold off drastically at the beginning of the week. We've seen a curve flattening, and we're looking at a 10-year U.S. Treasury yield right now at 166, whereas a month ago it was 126.
Yeah, and from a low of around just under 120, about 118, 119, we've had a significant rise. I think that's a function somewhat of a reaction to what the Fed has been trying to send signals on their policy. Certainly, the pullback in the market, I think, was a response to that increase in rates, because we've seen that, right? We saw that in the first quarter. We had a similar spike in rates of about 70 basis points. The market sold off, especially what we consider long-duration equities like tech and growth stocks. And we've seen that again here. What's interesting now, though, is rates have continued to move higher. We've seen the markets rebound. I think that's, you know, we're looking at, a strong earnings season. Once again, only, you know, we've got maybe 10% of companies that reported, but they're coming in some mixed reports. But overall, we've got about 80% of companies beating expectations. Yep. So that's helped the market.
Right.
If rates continue to rise, and it's typically, if it's a slow rise as a function of an expanding
yep.
economy, we can live with that.
Right.
When they spike or when they go up because of concerns about inflation, that's going to be problematic,
yep.
which inflation is probably our biggest issue relative to stock
right.
going forward.
All right, David. Hey, David, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. David Kudla, CEO and Chief Investment Strategist at Mainstay Capital.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher-level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
Let's talk now about the leading economic indicators, the leading index from the Conference Board right now, and what that's saying about the economy. In order to do that, we bring in Ataman Özeldrum. He's the Director of Economic Research and Global Research Chair at the Conference Board. If you type in EcoUS on your Bloomberg terminal, you can see the leading index came out at a slightly disappointing 0.2%. We were looking for 0.4%, and the previous month had been 0.9%. So, Ataman, thanks for joining us. Why the disappointment?
Good morning. Good to be here. So, the 0.2% is less than expected, but just keep it in perspective that is still a good positive number. It continues a rising trend in the leading index, but it is a little bit slower. A big reason for that this month in September was the large negative contribution to the index from housing residential construction. Some softening in consumer confidence also contributed to that. But all in all, the majority of the leading index components have been rising, 6 out of 10. So that still points to still a healthy expansion in the U.S. economy.
So, Ottoman, what do you make of the labor market out there? We've still got a lot of people that are not in this labor force, despite the very high number of job postings. Is this a permanent new reality for the U.S. labor market, that just fewer people are going to be working?
You know, I think the global pandemic has really caused a lot of disruption in labor markets in many sectors across the U.S. economy. And now, we're dealing with the Delta variant. That's creating more headwinds. It's keeping a lot of people on the sidelines because of, concerns about getting sick and, staying out of the labor force. I think in the future that'll eventually settle down. The economy growth rates are, settling down to our new expansion trajectory. And we're all getting used to, living with this. We're learning how to, work and shop. I think as things normalize, we'll see labor markets, going back to the trends that we had been seeing before the pandemic. That was really going back to lower unemployment rates and even labor shortages.
So, well, we have labor shortages now, right? I mean, one of the big problems is companies can't hire enough people.
Yeah, so I think there are probably two factors underlying those, right? One is the sort of the course of the pandemic with the Delta variant and people, not being willing to work especially in in-person services. So not being able to find the workers because of that low labor force participation. But there's also underlying all of this. The context is this longer-term demographic changes in the U.S. population, the aging population, the retirement of the baby boomers. So all of those are really leading to a smaller pool of labor supply that's available, and that's the larger context that we're operating in.
Well, I'm a boomer, and I'm working, and I'll continue to work for a while, I think.
I hope so.
Ottoman Alzadrom, thank you so much for joining us, the Director of Economic Research and Global Research Chair at the Conference Board. Again, the leading economic indicator for the month of September came in at 0.2%. Consensus was for 0.4%. We had a revision as well for the prior month. It was 0.9% growth, and that was revised down slightly to 0.8%. But still positive, and it'll be really interesting to see how this labor market continues to evolve post-pandemic. One of the more fascinating economic aspects of this pandemic and the fledgling recovery is the changing labor market. We've got still 5 or 6 million folks that are out of the labor force, yet there are more than 10 million job openings at the moment. And it's just that mix mash is really kind of interesting here. How will it develop? Well, our next guest has some thoughts on that, the radically changing labor market. Barry Ritholtz, founder of Ritholtz Wealth Management, Bloomberg opinion columnist, and the host of Masters in Business. So, Barry, what do you make of this labor market here? Seems to be a little bit different than what we had pre-pandemic.
Yeah, it certainly is. A number of things have changed, and we've talked about this on the air, about how a lot of workers took advantage of the past 18 months and having lots of cash in their bank accounts due to the generosity of the CARES Act, and they upskilled. They got certified, they got degrees, and for a lot of dead-end jobs, and there are really four industries that have run into a lot of trouble, hospitality, food service, most particularly, and they've, Elvis has left the building. They're no longer participating in those careers. And I think what we're starting to see, and I wrote about this about 6 months ago, is that the balance of power is shifting. And it's, we see these regular oscillations from capital to labor and back. Well, capital had the upper hand since the 1980s, it's shifting back to the direction of labor.
So one of the cool things about this, maybe not for employers, but for employees, is that they're going to get paid more. You know, whenever we talk to somebody who runs a hotel chain or restaurants, they always say, I can't get anybody to come in here. And I always say, well, why don't you just double their salary?
Right.
I'm sure they'll show up. Is that going to lead to a price wage spiral, though? Is that going to lead to inflation that sticks around?
So first, you have to look at the context and look more than just the past 6 months. By just about any measure, when we look at wages at the bottom half of the pay scale for the past 30 years, they have lagged just about everything, just about every measure. They've lagged inflation. They've lagged productivity. They've lagged corporate profits. They've lagged C-suite compensation, which certainly has been fairly robust for the past few decades. And so this is less of a, hey, we're driving inflation forward, and more of a, this is a reset. This is a catch-up for wages that really have been far too low. And when you have an economy that's operating at pretty close to full capacity, well, guess what? At a certain point, a limited commodity has pricing power. And in this case, that limited commodity is labor.
Barry, continuing on the labor discussion, 3 days a week hybrid, it just feels right now that that's where, at least in the U.S., this market is going to. Do you think that's the case? Is that good, bad? Do we care?
So, again, another really fascinating topic with a lot of moving pieces. So first, let's talk about the hybrid workforce, but also within that context, bring in challenging in hiring and inflationary wage push. And I have to start by pointing out productivity is so important in this space. The big surprise from the work from home has been not only was it not a drop in productivity, when you look at the go to Fred, look at productivity numbers, it's tripled over the past on an hourly output basis over the past 18 months. That's a massive increase. That's a huge change from, remember, Robert Solo famously quipped, you can see the computer age everywhere but in the productivity statistics. Well, here we are a generation later from when he said that in 1987. Productivity is going up tremendously. So first, huge offset of inflation. If you're paying people more, but you're getting more output from them, it's not inflationary. It's essentially a push. Now, the challenge is having that work its way downstream to bars and restaurants and hotels and frontline healthcare providers. In a lot of those fields, you're not seeing the same sort of productivity increase except where people have made those investments in technology. So you go to a restaurant and the waiter isn't writing down your order. They're using an iPad and you're not even getting a menu. You're just using your phone to scan that QR code on the table. Those sort of things gradually show up to the bottom line. They make things more productive, quicker, better. You know, if restaurants have a faster turnover, they're seating more people. They're making more revenue, serving more meals. So maybe you'll start to see productivity gains there. But white-collar workers, productivity gains have been spectacular.
Barry, got an important question. I'm moving back to New York in just a couple of months. I got a
reportedly
one-year-old daughter and a 3.8-liter flat-six in a stick-shift 911.
Boom, car discussion.
Right. And can you fit a baby seat in the back of that?
Or I think so. But my thought is this. I would love to give it to her. I met a guy the other day who had a
911. You're going to give the 911 to your
911.
Daughter?
Well, when she's older.
Yeah.
I met a guy the other day who was with his dad. He was 17 with his dad when he bought the car that he now drives.
Right.
And but I'm moving back. Freight rates are like $20,000 for a container.
No,
and used car prices
ship a car
are soaring.
Yeah.
do I let go of it before I come home? So, I mean, my daughter's going to live in a sea of self-driving electric cars. It's going to be pretty cool for her to get this
after
high school.
Very simple question. Is this an air-cooled 911 or a later war?
No, it's a 991, a 2013.
So hit that bid. You can sell that, take the profit, and then go buy yourself a car that will continue to appreciate.
Minivan.
No, although you don't need a minivan in New York. You can Uber wherever you're going. But if you want to give your daughter a 911, give her something that's going to be worth something in 20 years. A 2013, you know, water-cooled modern Porsche, they're great today, but, you know, 10 years from now, that's going to be pure electric. So go back to, what is it, pre-1998? Give her an air-cooled 911, and she'll teach her to drive a stick, and she'll be a happy camper.
I like it. Yeah, I'll go before that, because the last air-cooled was a 993. I don't like the way the headlights were so slanty. I like the 964 because I'm a child of the 80s, you know? That's the look for me. Not the turbo, just a simple 964. Maybe even an earlier 80s Carrera. Barry Ritholtz, always great to have you on. Bloomberg Opinion contributor. He runs Ritholtz Wealth Management, and he writes a blog as well called The Big Picture. This is Bloomberg. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Matt Miller. I'm on Twitter at MattMiller1973.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide at Bloomberg Radio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.